The UK Psych Health and Safety and ISO 45003 podcast. The goal of the UK Psych Health and Safety podcast is to be your source of information on psychological injury prevention, health promotion, and best practice. In doing this, we aim to rapidly advance the global practice of psychological health and safety in workplaces and adoption of best practices from the ISO 45003 standard. We will be looking at fully integrated approaches to managing psych health and safety and well-being strategy in the workplace that meet the needs of everyone in the organisation. Your regular host will be Peter Kelly, Senior Psychologist with the UK Health and Safety Executive, and Sheila Lord of BMR Health and Wellbeing. Every week, we will have a guest episode from the fields of health and safety, human resources, psychology, and academia who are leading the way in their corner of the globe.
Hi, and welcome back to the UK Psych Health and Safety podcast. My name is Sheila Lord, and I'm joined today again with my co-host Peter Kelly. And also joining us today is our guest, Joelle Mitchell. I hope I pronounced that right, Joelle. Head of Psychological Health and Safety at Flemish DX and also an organisational psychologist. Again, I hope I got that right in terms of the way I've pronounced it. So, Joelle, why don't you tell us about you, your experience, and for our listeners, what is exactly that an organisational psychologist does?
Yep, that's a good question, and that's a question that usually people ask me after I say that I'm an organisational psychologist. They'll say, "Oh, so you're good at organising things?" I don't help people with their hoarding problems or anything like that. No. An organisational psychologist. In Australia, it's what's called an endorsed area of practice. And to become an organisational psychologist, you need to have done a bachelor's degree in psychology and then a master's degree and then a period of an internship, essentially a sort of supervised period of practice. So an organisational psychologist applies the principles and theories and research of psychology to the organisational setting. So a group level setting, looking at the way that people behave when they're employed by an organisation. So at work or volunteering or whatever it might be. So it's really looking largely at group level dynamics. And you're looking at ways to essentially improve outcomes for people at work. And you can look at a range of different outcomes. So whether it's things like their productivity, if you're looking at, you can look at things like how to retain people at work for longer, how to recruit the right people for the right jobs. For me, my career has really focused on protecting the safety of people at work and looking at ways to improve safety outcomes for people when they're employed. And organisational psychologists tend to take a perspective that looks at the systems that are in place in an organisation rather than trying to focus on affecting sort of individual behavioural change. So we do tend to look more at the formal systems and structures that are in place in organisations as well as the social systems and structures and how they influence behaviours and outcomes for people.
Fantastic. So in terms of systems around psychological health, which is obviously the subject of the podcast and also the subject of the podcast you and Jason do. Again, what is a systemic program for psychological health? What does that kind of look like at an organisational level?
Yeah, well, ideally it would reflect sort of a lot of the same structures as your typical safety management system, and that's really what, if you're wanting to have a robust approach, then that's really the sort of approach that you want to take. So, it involves a lot of really good quality consultation with the workforce about understanding what the hazards are that they're experiencing. It needs that level of commitment from the top management within the organisation, because there is a reasonable commitment of resources, time, people, effort, all of that sort of thing to actually do it properly. And then from there, it just sort of flows down through your normal organizational structures. So you'll have policy around, you know, how we think about psychological health and safety and the commitments that we're going to make as an organization to address psychological health and safety. You know, there's the elements of, you know, people in the workforce that need to have particular levels of competence. They need to know how, you know, how to assess it, how to manage it, all of those types of things. General levels of education and literacy, I guess, across the workforce so that everybody is talking in the same language. And when we say, when we use a particular phrase, everybody knows what that phrase means. Mm-hmm. And then we need to actually have a good understanding of what the psychosocial hazards are that are present in the workplace, understand which of those hazards are contributing the most significant risk to the workforce, and depending on the work group, probably different hazards posing different levels of risk, and then working with those work groups to develop control measures to either eliminate that hazard or reduce the risk to people to a level that's as low as reasonably practicable. And then, of course, we also want to have systems to evaluate how effective those control measures are, whether they're doing what they're designed to do or not, if we need to have additional control measures, and all of those continuous improvement mechanisms that are typically built into our safety management system.
Fantastic. So from everything you've just said there, and I just kind of want to make the comparison, it's definitely not an overnight solution, isn't it?
No. No, you're looking at a long-term process to do it properly, yeah.
Yeah, and it's definitely not a we dip in and we dip out. It very much sounds like this has to be embedded in the organisation as part of the culture, as part of the continuous improvement, as important as, you know, financial accounting roles. This has to be this kind of cultural and leadership style of developing these systemic programmes.
Yeah, look, it's certainly not just a sort of sheep dip. You know, we'll train everybody in, you know, mental health awareness, and then, you know, that's it. We'll leave them to it. That's certainly not doing psychological health and safety in the right way.
Yeah, and psychological health and safety, it only just seems like now with the release of the 45003 standard that this is kind of getting airtime and is being talked about a lot more in organisations, or there's more of an awareness of it coming along now. I mean, you guys, obviously, you're based in Australia. How do you see that kind of being taken on board by businesses and by business leaders? Are people embracing it? Is there still a resistance and a want to just stick with what we know in terms of I've ticked a box, I've done some mental health training, I've got Bendy Brenda in on Friday with the yoga and the fruit bowls. What's the kind of adoption, should I say, of psych health and safety in practice?
I would say that it's really quite variable. And I think, you know, a lot of organisations will think that, well, we've done some training, so people know what mental health is and they know, you know, what the symptoms are if they need to seek help. We've got an EAP that people can go and talk to if they need to. And, you know, they sort of think that they've done mental health then. So I think that there's an element of it that's just a little bit of a lack of knowledge about what's actually necessary. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a bit of a fear of the unknown where, you know, organisations think about, you know, they hear the term psychological and they think that, you know, you're actually talking about people who are already in a state of psychological illness or injury and need to be treated. But when we can actually start to reframe the way that they're thinking about it and use language of hazard and risk and give them examples of the types of things that we mean when we say psychosocial hazard, we sort of start to see a bit of a light bulb happening for them when they understand what we actually mean when we're talking about prevention. We're not talking about early intervention once somebody's already sick. We're actually talking about eliminating or reducing exposure to the hazards. So I think that a lot of it is in the language that we're using, and the more that we can adopt that language of risk and hazard, the more organisations are going to start to get a better understanding of what we actually mean and why just giving people awareness training isn't enough.
Okay. Pete?
I just agree with what Jolie's saying. I mean, I think if we're honest. I mean, there's an abject failure, really, from organisations to address this as an issue, as a hazard over the course of the where we find ourselves in the last 20 years, but particularly in the last year. I don't know about yourself, but work was very ill prepared for changing the very social dynamic, psychosocial way we work overnight like that. So, I'm curious as to what you think are the additional hazards that perhaps we didn't see 18 months ago, and how that's increased the probability of the risk of people developing substantial mental health issues.
So I think, do you mean in terms of people working sort of from home and in isolation and that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I think that, the working from home is an interesting one, and it really depends on, I think, the way that organisations have gone about structuring that. Because there's, a significant opportunity for work to bleed into home. And I think sometimes organisations are happy for that to happen when it's work bleeding into home, but not when it's home bleeding back into work. So they're happy for you to spend an extra hour after your knock-off time finishing up emails because you've been on Zoom calls all day, but they're not happy for you to pop off for 10 minutes to put your, your washing in the dryer or that sort of thing. So, it sort of needs to go both ways in that case. And, then you've got the added issues of, having kids at home and you're trying to do the homeschooling as well as trying to do your work. I think that it all really comes down to the employer having reasonable expectations of a workforce, and where that's in place, I think the levels of distress for people associated with workload anyway and feeling like they need to be proving that they're working, where those employers are having reasonable expectations of people, at least that particular hazard isn't as much of an issue for people, where employers are able to say, yeah, this is a weird situation for everybody and we're all just going to do the best that we can, and sort of have some trust in the workforce that they're actually going to be trying to do the right thing as well.
I mean, I guess the key to that is leadership, isn't it? I talk about empathic and authentic leadership, which are, traits or components of being a good leader. But do you agree maybe there's a need for systemic leadership in this approaches so that actually that systems are developed in the work to almost facilitate what we're trying to do is to get these outcomes. And I think what the pandemic perhaps did was expose very clearly that the systems weren't robust, but where they had a good leadership, and I'm thinking of a couple of companies I've worked with over here where there was a clear steer from the leadership of what the expectations were during this pandemic and after the pandemic, and given that the world of work and how we work will change fundamentally, leadership has to be at the heart of it. And I know I'd be interested in your views on, how you create strategic engagement and get people to think from a strategy perspective as both leaders and as supervisors and, as employee representatives, should you have trade union,
I think there's a mindset shift that needs to happen, and that's, associating productivity with being physically present. For me, that's the fundamental thing that has to change before you can even start looking at any systems or anything like that. If you've got, leaders in the organisation that associate presenteeism with productivity, you've got a big problem. We've all seen those stories about companies that make people have the Zoom window open all day to make sure that they're at their desk, or that, taking a screenshot of their monitor every 15 minutes or something to make sure that they're working and all of that sort of thing. I mean, that's, you know, I can't imagine what it would be like to work somewhere like that.
It's the workhouses of the workhouses, isn't it? Well, that level of control, or almost 1984 Orson Welles, you know, that, you know, being controlled by a greater power. But yeah,
absolutely, being constantly monitored. So I think, you need that mindset change. And I think then, you know, it comes down to, well, how do we actually determine whether people are actually, you know, meeting their performance requirements? And we've got existing tools and things that we use to monitor that. So we just need to get away from this idea of hours of attendance being equivalent to productivity. And obviously, you know, when you're in a type of job where you do literally clock in and clock out, that's a little bit different. But for, you know, for people who are involved in knowledge work, it's more about the, you know, your deliverables, isn't it?
Even I think maybe even in the clock in, clock out environment, you can do changes to that workplace to make it more adaptable and approachable to people's needs. Yes, you've got to be in by what a certain time, you've got to leave. It's what you're doing, you know, during that time to make people feel engaged with their work. And it's been fascinating to watch people's who wanted to work at home pre-pandemic being forced to work at home, and then trying to find the systems to make that work, and changing the way line managers manage people. And I've had a few conversations with line managers saying, you know, really been hard for us, Pete, because I've gone from face-to-face having a coffee with someone to face-to-face having a coffee with you over the Zoom, and it doesn't quite feel the same for them as line managers. So I'm sure as leaders, having to adapt and change to that will have caused them level of distress. And I think it's interesting. We always talk about the worker, but also within this context, we're talking about, you know, leadership and strategic leadership. A part of that is, well, how do we support our leaders who are trying to deliver what we want? How would you say we do that? I mean, what things can we do to encourage them to make it common practice to, you know, to apply the principles that we're looking around, you know, empathy and compassion, authenticity? Should it be embedded in KPIs? I've spoken with Jason about this before and others. You know, should we make organizations report on what they're doing on their mental health promotion?
I'm not an enormous fan of KPIs because I just see how blatantly they get manipulated.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, you know, sure, we could have some KPIs around, you know, around employee mental health, but it all that is going to happen is that people are going to find creative ways to report things. So, you know, I think we're better off actually just avoiding KPIs and actually focusing on developing good quality, robust processes. So yeah, there's definitely a really significant element of upskilling leaders in those areas of sort of empathy and compassion, and just, you know, thinking about your employees as human, and recognizing that, you know, you when you get to work, you've still got all of your other stuff with you. You can't just leave your home life at the door when you clock in. And the same as when you go home, you're taking your work stuff with you in your brain as well. So now I've got off track.
No, you're on track. You're on track, trust me. No, I mean, I have the same concerns about KPIs. I recommend them, but I do know you can manipulate them. I would rather have other people influencing those KPIs, so the likes of the insurance companies, or reporting bodies and that. But what you're suggesting is, for me, the heart of what we're trying to do, which is actually have behavioural change at the level of the management, leadership, supervision, and that would feed into feeding to like growing people's mental health awareness and mental health sort of promotion stuff. Because we're going into a time now where people are going to talk about mental health, they're going to talk about well-being, but they could just default back to the individual, couldn't they not?
Well, I think that is what happens, is that there's all of this stuff about, you know, understanding mental health and it's okay to ask for help and all of that sort of stuff, but it's still really just putting the onus on the individual to take responsibility for protecting themselves from the hazards that they're exposed to. You know, so it's pushing the ownership of the risk down to essentially the sharp end of the organization. There's a lot of risk. The risk that should be owned by top management isn't being addressed, isn't being owned, isn't being treated. We've trained you, so now it's up to you. And if you end up with a psychological injury, it's because you weren't practicing those resilience skills and you weren't doing enough mindfulness meditation during the day, even though, you know, we've got the video camera on you, so we can't catch you with your eyes closed having a meditation, even though that's one of the control measures that we've told you that you need to use to protect yourself. But you can't do that on work time. You have to do that in your own time, which work is infringing upon anyway, because you're here, you know, we're here in your home. I mean, that's my most cynical read of the situation. And obviously, you know, not every workplace is like that. And I'm taking it to a fairly dark place to drive the point home, I guess. But
it's a place I've been at, so it's okay.
it's not a good place to be. And, you know, even for leaders as well, they're also experiencing that that culture and those pressures themselves, and that's why they're pushing it down into their teams too. So it does come from the top. The messaging comes from the top, and I think that it needs to be not only communication from top management about what their expectations are and having those reasonable and human expectations, but that needs to be supported through things like policy that actually allows for leaders to make decisions to adapt to what a team member needs at any particular point in time. But it also does need that, you know, sort of systematic assessment of the hazards to say, well, all right, what about globally? What can we do to reduce these particular hazards? You know, we can see that these are arising, you know, as a result of the systems of work that we have in place. So what can we do about our systems of work to try to get rid of those hazards or reduce their significance?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, we assume by doing something on mental health that it's all glory and there are no pitfalls. But there can be pitfalls if it's not done right, I guess. And one of the things the Farmer Stevenson review over here set out six principles, and within that was one of those was having a mental health action plan and what that looked like. And it didn't necessarily... It isn't just a reactive, responsive thing. It's both, you know, you've got an illness, deal with it, but actually you've got these other things that you need to do and what to. It's interesting you talk about control and control measures being, so resilience and mindfulness and that. I'd be interested to explore that with you because, you know, obviously the perception is if you make people resilient, you make them mindful, that somehow that it will by association mean that there's going to be a sea change in their behavior. And somehow that correlates to the organization feeling like they're managing people's mental health. Reality is very different, isn't it?
Well, yeah. And I think that just reflects a fundamental lack of understanding about what resilience actually means and, you know, what mindfulness can actually achieve. You know, they're not silver bullets. Yeah. You know,
they're sold as silver bullets, aren't they?
Well, they are, you know, and isn't everything though.
They're also very cheap.
Yeah, and that's it. It's the sheep dip. We can put everybody through this training and then we can wash our hands of it and be done with it. And yeah. Look, I, we can take a very cynical perspective of it, or we can perhaps be a little bit more generous and say that it's coming out of a lack of knowledge. And, you know, that's really what we're sort of trying to do here through these podcasts, isn't it, to help educate those people who do actually genuinely want to be doing the right thing, and sort of help them understand why those just purely training-based approaches aren't enough. And then, you know, for organisations that maybe don't really care, hopefully we're able to convince them a little bit of why it's maybe a good idea that they do start to care.
Well, I don't think people are going to really, businesses, if they want to grow and move through the latter stages of this pandemic and the recession, there has to be a change, because the way that we work, the world of work will be different and is going to be different. For some of us who as organizational psychologists have spent the last 10 to 20 years promoting the fact that work can be contribute to health rather than ill health, then that is more than ever true now, is it not, with what we've come through. It's interesting, there's obviously different countries at different areas, but when most of us are talking about a post-pandemic world now, but actually the pandemic will be there and will be sustained over a period of time. The long-term impact in terms of people's approaches to work, their mental health, is going to come in. And I think organizational psychologists that we are, we have a duty to make sure people are aware of, you know, what are the things that are happening in the world of work that are potentially going to cause people distress.
Certainly. That's an important role. And I think also as organizational psychologists, we can actually look to the systems and look to things like work design to be able to, you know, inform systems of work that are actually going to be protective of or enhancing of mental health.
Let me ask you this question. Effort reward imbalance, right? For those, it's a theory that was promoted by a nice gentleman called Segrist. How does effort reward imbalance, which says that the amount of effort and the reward to get back is dissociated, how does that go where we are now at the moment in terms of we've asked people fundamentally move everything away, do things fundamentally different, but the reward or the perceived reward is less? Do you think that's going to be something that's going to come back to haunt organisations where they've realised that actually they haven't put the right rewards in, but all the effort was on the individual?
Short answer is yes. absolutely. You know, the situation will change. If it's an employer's market at the moment, that's not going to be the case forever. Employees have long memories. You know, they might be happy to keep their job right now, and they might have to just sort of suck it up and do whatever they feel that they need to do to maintain their income and, you know, to be able to support themselves and their families and all of that sort of thing. But there's going to come a day when there are other options available, and, you know, the organizations that have looked after their people during this pandemic are the ones who are going to keep their people, and the organizations who haven't are the ones who are going to find themselves with a fairly significant turnover.
Absolutely.
Or scraping the bottom of the barrel as far as
being able to get
a recruitment pool.
Yeah. It's interesting because if you look back at the Times 500 companies to work for over the course of the last 10 to 15 years, companies that progress and have been high productivity, low staff turnover, and are working, are those that invest in people's health and well-being. So there's some that have already started this journey, but it's ironic the very things we just talked about there that we think we're going to need is what we were already seeing in good organisations. And it's where they go now with that, isn't it? What's the next level? And I think that's the conversation piece we're having around 45,003 is, do we put a system in place? Do we make sure people can assess psychological health and safety and well-being, and what does that look like? And but it's fascinating that the principles, that the same principles of what people want in work, is they want to be looked after, they want to be sustained, and they want to go home safe and healthy, which is the basis of all the regulatory bodies that in the world that do this on health and safety. You know, that it's that principle. So it's fascinating that the things we've had in the past are actually still completely relevant now.
Well, because we're still human, you know, we still have the same needs. We still have the same fundamental needs. Our environment has changed drastically in terms of, you know, we have this meta global event happening that's had a significant change on our working environments and on our social environments, but our fundamental human needs remain.
Yeah, and work is a place to address them, does it not?
It certainly does. It's where we spend the majority of our waking time as adults. So yes, work absolutely has a significant role to play in meeting those needs. It's a mutual obligation, but the pendulum swings both ways.
That's where the conflict comes, though, isn't it? When they're not met, because there isn't that perception that there's that crossover. Where you get people becoming, it's the paradigm of stress, isn't it? You know, that where they're not actually getting what they need, they're not getting a sense of being of purpose, which is really important. So I'm sure Jason makes you feel good, though, doesn't he? Obviously, an employer.
We have a lot of fun. I'm pretty mean to Jason a lot of the time, and that makes me pretty happy. So,
well, absolutely, that's an entirely another podcast.
Well, look, I mean, you know, what kind of work environment is it when you can just rag on your boss all day and it's all fine? You know, it's a pretty good work environment.
You're gonna have to explain to the UK what a rag is. I know what a rag is. Ragging.
Pulling the piss. Would that be
Yeah.
Once that exists, yeah. So, with the new standard.
I've just gone off on a conversation.
That's like
a
coffee shop. So,
how unusual for you, Pete.
So, Joelle, Pete mentioned the 45003 standard, just touched on it before. I mean, what's your view as to the potential that this can have for organisations being able to address psychological health and have this systemic process in place at a global scale? What's your view on that, and what do you think some of the potential pitfalls are? So some of the kind of, you know, potential wins and some of the potential pitfalls there.
I think that the wins are that it makes quite clear how psychological health and safety, how psychosocial risk management can be embedded within your existing risk management processes, and it shows how it can be aligned with your existing management system, whether it's safety, quality, risk, whatever, all of those that sort of fit within that ISO management system series. So I think that the alignment is really helpful, especially for those bigger businesses that do like to adopt those ISO standards. And even for smaller businesses who might not want to adopt the entire thing, I think that there's a lot of useful information in there. And I think that it steps through the progress in a fairly logical way as well, you know, so it does go through sort of loosely following the Plan, Do, Check, Act process. So, you know, the front end of it is really about, well, what are the things that we actually need to establish first before we get to the point of looking at hazards? What's all of the work that we need to do in the front end to actually make sure that we're ready to look at those hazards and ready to implement these systems so that they've got the best opportunity for success? Pitfalls. I think, you know, with anything, you sort of you take what you can from it, and then look for other opportunities as well. You know, standards are a good guide, but you shouldn't just be relying on them solely. You know, it's got a long list of different examples of hazards, but that shouldn't be. You know, you shouldn't just get that list of hazards and tick them off and say, "Yep, this one applies and this one doesn't." I think you need to really look at that as a starting point. And then progress further and use that potentially as a way to consult and have conversations with your workforce, and then use that consultation to inform the next steps that you take around, well, what are we going to do about this, and how can we actually improve the situation? So it's a starting point, and it provides a good entry, but it's not the end.
No, yeah, so, and it is, yeah, very much that, isn't it? It's a base framework from which you put the structure in, and then you build that around your organisation and the other needs that kind of come out from that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it should fit within established regulatory frameworks, although it's a voluntary standard, which I emphasise, it's voluntary. It does need to fit within that. We've had some conversations about some of the content based on what you'd previously seen. I know you had a particular opinion that you shared about hazards and how to manage the hazards. Did you want to share that?
I I maybe won't use the words that I used.
No, that's fine. But I mean, that's what we're here for.
So I think there was a... I had noticed that it had mirrored fairly closely the parent standard 45001, and then I noticed that towards the end of clause 6, the clause in 45001 that said develop an action plan to address these risks was absent from 45003, which I found a little bit odd, I suppose, because it seemed
frustrating.
Frustrating, yeah. That's probably a bit of a politer term than I used. And then I guess element 8 then sort of goes in more detail into assessing risk, and then it talks about control measures more in element 8, which I also found a bit interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because element 8 is more about operational implementation and sort of using it in your day-to-day work. So it almost seems to take the obligation away from the employer to own the risk, and it still puts it to the sort of, on your daily work to identify and address risk rather than looking at systemic approaches.
Yeah. No, I get that. I, when that point was raised, obviously, I went and looked back at it, as you do. But, yeah, there is... I think when you read it, the standard in whole, and when it does come out next month, I think some of those concerns that you've got there will be addressed. But it's the location of where they're addressed, rather than if you see what I mean in terms of, and I think that's part of any development of any standards is these conversations and discussions about where something goes and at which point you do what. And A, B, and C, but no, I think it's a valid point. Hopefully, the full standard will kind of address some of that. But I mean, we're starting from a template of nothing, effectively.
Yeah, well, that's it. And we can always still go back to the parent standard and say, well, that one has that clause, so we should do it anyway.
Yes, yeah, and that's exactly what you can do. They call it the mothership. It's the mothership. Let me ask this question. For us, who've been dabbling in this area of the world of work and mental health for a number of years, is it the panacea? Does it offer the potential to be the thing that we've waited for? Or should it be viewed as part of a system of other things? What's your take on it? I mean, there's a lot of excitement about it.
Um, I Yeah, I don't think that anything should be referred to as a panacea. Once we start thinking that there's just one thing to rule them all, that's when we start to get into a little bit of trouble. So, you know, it's a useful tool that we can use. It can help us on our way to where we want to be. But no, certainly not the be all and end all.
Now, that for me is what I would want to hear, which is actually it's a component really of a good management system. And it's, you know, it's a component of a safety management system. And then obviously, you know, addressing the health and safety issues that we've seen there. I'd be interested before we go to talk briefly about the recent launch in Australia of the new legislation. Are you able to talk around that?
I think we've had the ministers, the WH ministers from the different states have reached a agreement around the inclusion of psychological injury in the WHS
workers' compensation as well. It's sort of embedded in that as well.
Ministerial agreement is one step in the process, but then obviously there's all of the drafting and the debating and the politicking that goes on around that. So, you know, it's positive, I guess, that all of the ministers have reached an agreement in principle. But, you know, I'll withhold my celebrations until I actually see the legislation in writing.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because it's made over here and there's already conversations about the fact that this was happening in Australia. And I think, you know, it's, as usual, Australia in some of these areas tends to lead or tends to be ahead of the game. But hopefully, well, you know, it'll be a positive add-on, won't it, to what's already there.
Hopefully. I mean, so they're talking about having a set of regulations around psychosocial risk management. I think that's probably the most significant thing that they've agreed to. But that's going to really depend on what the detail of the regulations actually is. You know, what is the language that they're using there, and you know, what direction are they providing organisations? Because if they get too prescriptive, it's probably it will be helpful for some businesses, but potentially harmful for others, because then what are you missing? And, you know, I come from the petroleum industry, and we, you know, learned the hard way about overly prescriptive legislation back in, you know, Piper Alpha days. So I guess that's where my mind is sitting at the moment is, you know, what are those regulations actually going to look like? What's the language going to be like in them? And that really, to me, is going to be the key to whether they're helpful or potentially more of a hindrance.
Yeah, which is it's a wait and see, isn't it, I guess, to see how it pans out. I mean, I think in principle it seems a good thing.
It is, but then it's, you know.
I'd like to have it.
The other issue is then whether or not the states choose to adopt the model regulations or not. So, you know, at the moment we've got the model WHS Act, which a few states have adopted, but they've all made their own amendments to it. So we don't actually have the principle behind the model Act has been lost largely anyway. So,
No, that's cool. I mean, we've come to our 45 minutes too quick as usual. but yeah, in terms of this whole area, what would be your one take-home message to businesses when it comes to the management of mental health in work?
So I guess you need to get out of the mindset that mental health issues are just things that people bring with them from home. You need to recognise that the work environment that you create, the systems of work that you create, can have either a positive or a negative effect on people's mental health, and those are the things that you need to start thinking about.
sound advice.
That's brilliant.
Is that us done, Sheila?
Yeah, that's us done for this week. So I just want to say thank you to Joelle and also to you again, Peter.
You've been listening to the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention and the new ISO 45003 standard, follow subscribe to the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.ukpsychhealthandsafety.com.